From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Alexandra Fuller is our guest. You may know her from her best-selling memoirs, her funny and brutally honest stories of growing up in southern Africa with an eccentric family. These days, she lives in a yurt in Jackson Hole, and her latest book is a novel about two cousins on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. It's fiction, but still very much based on what she's learning about race and land and time. We'll be right back.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me, and I forget. Teach me, and I may remember. Involve me, and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events, too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Up until now, Alexandra Fuller has published memoirs. Maybe you read Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, where she relates in brutal but loving honesty her childhood in Africa with an eccentric family, a mother and father she describes as wonderful parents who were dreadful at parenting. Her books have explored a central contradiction she felt growing up, that is, being part of a group of white settlers who oppressed the native people they displaced, and yet feeling deeply connected to the land and the culture of Africa. More than 20 years ago, Fuller came to the United States, to the American West, to Wyoming, and she still sees those contradictions, but this time she's writing about them in fiction. Fuller has just published her first novel. It's the story of two Oglala Lakota men on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Fuller is joining us today to talk about that book. It's called Quiet Until the Thaw. In 2011, she had gone to the reservation to take part in this annual horseback ride they do. She went a couple of hundred miles on a borrowed, green, broke Indian war pony, and the experience just changed her.
Yeah, I'd been writing for sort of mainstream magazine for a long time, 17 years, and I'd been begging and begging to be sent onto the reservation because being out west, if you're, you know, a writer and also an immigrant, the two things that really strike you, you want to wrestle with the tropes that you've been given, which are in Wyoming, cowboys and Indians. And I'd written a book of nonfiction about how cowboys, you know, in the west really no longer round up cattle. They're working on oil rigs or, you know, flatbed trucks. And that we've shifted that identity of what we, the idyllic cowboy is, that very little of that is left except the rhetoric. And I was desperate to see, you know, what had happened to this other trope that we get sort of thrown and the noble sort of silent, you know, image one has, I think, from Westerns of quote unquote Indians. But riding onto the res, I came to the res correct, as they say. You know, I arrived exhausted, very humbled. I can ride a horse. I grew up on the things. I cannot ride like a Lakota. I don't have anywhere near like the toughness, endurance. It was 104 degrees. You know, I look over, there's three little kids all bareback on one horse just going hell for leather. I could barely keep up. I finally looked at this kid next to me. I said, how do you slow these things down? You know, 10 miles into this 200-mile ride. And he goes, well, usually a bullet stops them. I mean, these things just are tough. And so, you know, by the time I got onto the res, I already understood this is a community in active resistance against white settlers. This is a community in active, lively discussion with their ancestors. This is a community actively reattaching to language, very attached to land, and with a very expansive idea of nationhood, meaning they extended nationhood to rocks, to trees, to animals, to wildlife in a way that was authentic. It was and sustainable, you know. And so for me, it was really this. I was for that weird sort of time while I was on assignment. You know, I had a husband who was in catastrophic dire straits in a hospital in Salt Lake City, recovering from a terrible riding accident. And at the same time, I was, you know, going back to the res to be on this assignment and soaking up, you know, the wisdom and resilience and stories of the Lakota like a sponge, like I needed it, like air.
It's so interesting that you say that you felt like going onto the reservation or going on this ride was an unexpected homecoming, as you put it. If home is where you can settle in, recognition is how you describe it. And I wonder, is part of your connection to it, the recognition you felt, the kind of remembrance of your ancestry of white settlers in Africa, in the sense that white settlers had gone to Africa to establish themselves, make a home, but then they engaged in that same kind of violence American white settlers did. You know, in that sense, did you sense a similar kind of violent history, you know, whites imposing themselves on these first peoples? Was that part of not the appeal, obviously, but kind of the recognition of the connection between the two?
100%. And yeah. I had more than that. I mean, what's so interesting? So when you live through something, you don't analyze it. You're a kid. You know, I lived through a childhood which was not just white settlers, but we were white supremacists. You know, there were 100,000 white people controlling the votes, the narrative, the schools, the hospitals for 6 million black people in the case of, you know, then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. But I had just also been on assignment in South Africa to look at post-apartheid violence and to go, you know, to the former homelands and to the townships, Soweto and Alexandria, which, you know, that stamp of racial capitalism is unmistakable. It's a very... I might not know the particulars of what it means to be indigenous, say, Mashona or Manika or Zulu or Xhosa or Lakota, but I absolutely recognize that unmistakable stamp of racial capitalism, which assumes that you can steal the land and steal the labor of anyone not white. And so when people sort of say, have this trope, the white settler trope, which is almost identical, by the way, in Rhodesia as it is here, a very brave narrative of pioneers, and you really, you know, we were steeped as children in the stories of their heroics, sort of trekking across Africa, or in the case of, yeah, trekking across, you know, the U.S. to get to the promised land, in our case, Rhodesia. And to say, you know, that, well, my great-grandfather came here with nothing, and it's disingenuous. I mean, they came, the whites settled Rhodesia with the full force of British military behind them. I mean, that's not nothing. And then usurped the labor and land of the population that existed, which meant that there was this extensive period of privilege and productivity for whites that lasted about 100 years. But the center couldn't hold that kind of stolen disparity. You know, it's biblical, it's Jung, it's everyone. You know, eventually, unto seven generations, the sins of the fathers will be accounted for.
What was it about that ride, though? I'm sure this occurred to you, obviously, before you went on that ride. But it seems that going there was different.
Right. That's right. It took it, I think, because the sort of dominant narrative here is puts Indians into a very historical perspective, puts the abuse of indigenous people into a past tense. Being there on the ride, being in the middle of Lakota resistance, being in the middle of a conversation in which I was completely ignored. I mean, the other really comfortable thing was that the first time since moving here, I was again a minority among a majority. That's what the ride did for you. It shifts your perspective, your white noise, I call it. You know, your dominant narrative gets quieter. And you start to listen, wow, there's another side to this. It's very, very difficult to notice when you're the oppressor, when you're the privileged. It's much more easy to know. You can't help but notice when a boot is on your throat. But to see what that looked like, didn't look like victimhood, didn't look like all the other tropes that we get, you know, told that sort of Native Americans exist off, you know, federal handouts and tax breaks and casinos, and they're fine, and their history is their history. From the Lakota perspective, the Indian wars are not over, because the treaties between the indigenous communities and the U.S. government have all been broken, violated, ignored, or changed, or altered. And so that for me was an absolute critical moment to come so physically, so undeniably experiencing, you know, this Lakota sense of being as the dominant sense of being for that time, in which my life depended on me being able to fit into that, was a very important experience. And not to come with that whole white attitude of what can I do? How can I be here for the voiceless? I mean, we all know that's rubbish, and yet we keep continuing in that trope. Arundhati Roy says there's no such thing as the voiceless. There's the deliberately unheard and the preferably silenced.
Yeah. In Leaving Before the Rains Come, you describe your first impression of the United States when you came here. You came here, you said yes to Charlie. Charlie asks you to get married, and you lay the story out in that book. And you said that you knew when you said yes to him that it was a certain forever yes, that it would change your life, that you would go and kind of like your Scottish grandmother who agreed to go on a picnic with your grandfather and then ends up changing her life too. So you knew it was a forever sort of thing. And you describe your first impression of the West as relief, but also a puzzle. And I wanted to ask you about that, because you say the U.S. seemed, I mean, you came to the West in the United States, so wild in some ways, but you also saw something that was kind of settled and tamed, and resolved was the word you also used.
Right. And I think it's very much part of our narrative here is to act as if the story begins and ends with us. And I think it was so instructive growing up among, you know, the Manika of Zimbabwe, whose attitude is at that point very oppressed in the 70s. You know, the war was ongoing. There was so much violence all the time. But their whole attitude towards us, with me even, was, you know, enjoy where you are, because you don't know where you are in the cycle. You don't know where you are in the story. You don't know if you're at the beginning or the middle and the end. And there was something about that that gave, that's very funny, weirdly. You can immediately see the absurdity of holding on to your position on the cycle. Soon as I was with the Lakota, same thing. It's a cycle. You can try and kick it, but you're not going to fight old age and suffering.
It's interesting, your own understanding of the land. I mean, you were really honest about this. You said that you had inherited an understanding of land from Southern Africans, who on one hand, they didn't see, as you say, this separation of soil and soul. So you have that way of dealing with a land. But then you had the European one, which saw land as a commodity. So you had both of those kind of conflicting ideas of land. Did you go back and forth between them from time to time?
That's a great question. I'm really trying to be honest about this, because I think it's an incredibly important question for my, you know, for me, for our time. But I think that, listen, when you're raised to believe in the superiority of your race, you don't question it. You question very little. You know, why would you question? Some adult tells you that you're just entitled to this, but there's no explanation about it. However, it didn't make sense to me dominating the land. It didn't be, and I think what was most instructive was the land itself, because it flooded. There would be drought. It's too strong. I would look at this massive, you know, the whole of Africa to play in, as my father used to say. And I would think, you people aren't going to win against this. It looked like an embattlement. Whereas, you know, the Manika, when they would talk to me about the land, they would say, well, that's where the ancestors live, in that bunch of trees, and this is what we use this pod for. And if we come here, they would have a story about the place. It wasn't just a kind of insistent that this land now owes you a living for nothing, but that it is a relationship in which you give, you receive, you mostly receive. You would never think just to take. And of course, the way that, you know, the appropriations was set up in Rhodesia and in the U.S., the same thing. The way that the land was sort of apportioned meant that it was incredibly difficult, almost, I would say, impossible for Black indigenous people or for Native Americans to actually make a living the way that the land has been set up. And the clue for me really was to realize, oh, the whole point of racial capitalism is that it is built by minorities, by Black people, by anyone who you can rope into enslaving, by indigenous people, by, you know, in some cases, the Chinese for the railways and that sort of thing. But when it collapses, and it will collapse, it's designed to collapse on top of the people who built it. you know, that was the real sort of shock. The thing that hit me in the stomach was I recognize how this goes.
That's Alexandra Fuller. Her latest book is called Quiet Before the Thaw. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Alexandra Fuller about her latest book. It's a novel called Quiet Before the Thaw. There are two themes that I wanted to ask you about. Well, I guess among others, but two in particular I wanted to tease out. One was the idea of God, or your relationship. I don't know if that's quite the right way to put it. But you talk about how one of the things that when you were married to Charlie and living in Africa is that he had tried to rescue you and your family from your chaos. And you spend a lot of time in your memoirs before describing that kind of chaos. And like he was saying, he was trying to save us from this kind of reckless life that we lived. And you say that there was a time in your life when you tried to believe in these ideas of control, these systems of control. That's how you put it in the book. And in fact, you kind of tried to believe in God. And in fact, you tried these experiments to see if, in fact, there was a God. And I wanted you to just talk about that, giving this a shot anyway when you were a kid, this idea of order.
Right, right. Well, I think it's very, very important when you have a very rigid, very conservative, very race-based community, the white supremacy that I mean, they didn't wear white sheets, but they certainly were trying to hold down a white sort of perspective. And so one of the clues that you're being raised by white supremacists is if your God is, you know, sort of very, man, the guy's all knowing and he knows all about your thoughts and they're, none of them are good thoughts and you, there's no... So, I mean, so this very limited idea of God, what you end up with, I think, is shutting down yourself. And, you know, our Jesus was very sort of, I joke that he was Jesus of the Aryan nation. He looked like a love child of Kurt Cobain and, you know, Celine Dion. But there wasn't this, you know, we weren't really taught the teachings of Christ. We were taught to be suspicious and hateful and fearful and that, and to really use the Bible and to justify, you know, our contempt of homosexuals and people of color and that kind of thing. And what was so harrowing for me was as an adult, when I was, you know, writing for the same magazine that sent me to the res, and I went to South Africa to study post-apartheid violence, I met a young white supremacist who had been raised in an orphanage, had been rescued, so-called rescued, from the orphanage by an extreme white ring group that had taken him up to the Karoo, off the grid, taught him to run, you know, taught him, just brainwashed him. And then 2 weeks after his 18th birthday, sent him to bomb a predominantly black community because then he would take the rap, right? Mm-hmm. And so now he has life in prison. And he said to me, it was this unbelievable gift from God, honestly, to go talk my way into Pretoria Central, which was quite a mission, and to talk to this guy. And both of us agree the God that we found after we were raised, the God that we found was a liberating God, liberating for all people. And that was both of our clues that liberation is internal. It's it's what Aldous Huxley says, you know, liberties can't be given. They can only be taken. You're the only one who can liberate yourself. Minority communities understand that. They understand that their actual liberties are being taken, but you can't give someone their liberty. That's a ridiculous idea. It's such a contempt of the human soul. And so for me, my understanding of God as it, I first had to almost kill the God that I was given as a child, this very judgmental, white supremacy, homophobic, other hating, racist, xenophobic man. And my idea of the divine softened and became much more that of the divine of the indigenous people I was raised with, and also much more in keeping with what I understand about Lakota spirituality, which is that the divine is within, the divine is everywhere. Turns out you treat things better and you treat yourself better and you treat other people better if you experience them as containing God. They are a vessel. I mean, and this is not out of keeping with Protestant teaching. It's just that the Protestants have decided, from the point of view of power, I suppose, to put God in the priesthood, sort of up there on the altar, and the rest of us sitting here godless and needing God. There is no distance you have to go to God. God was always there. I mean, I think that's the one thing about losing siblings early. You know, I was born after a dead brother from meningitis. My sister drowned while I was supposed to be, you know, looking after her. And then I had a younger brother die some years later. So and then there was the war, and then there was, yeah, I mean, it was a violent, you know, childhood, and it made you begin to question soul. And so, I mean, of course, when you're little, you look up to the adults, and it really seemed to me that the God that they were introducing me to was transactional, that if I gave him my life in return, I would have a parking place, you know, or I would pass my math exam, or my baby sister would be able to live again. Like, if I could hold my breath or drown myself, God was magical. He could kill me but give my little sister back to the family. I thought that would be a fair trade. So you when you've done all those really tough negotiations as a little person and then decided, you know what, actually, this is all lies, then having to find God as an adult, I feel like it's in a way, it's a second marriage. It's a...
Yeah.
I'm coming to God, I think, much more honestly, and my idea of God is so much more expansive. I mean, it truly is a mystery. It's amazing we're having a shot at trying to describe it, but it certainly encompasses the feminine and the wild and the indigenous and minorities and immigrants and the poor, just as much as it, you know, encompasses the bishops and the priests and the Pope.
Do you think in some way that's what you meant? Well, I've heard you talk about this, that you wanted through this new novel to kind of get at the way the Lakota think, Lakota thinking. Is that part of what occurred to you when you went on the res?
Right. Listen, I am under no illusion that I can speak for the Lakota or that I need to. But what I want, and I am under no illusions that I have, you know, that my readership tend to be white settlers. I mean, that's who I tend to be introduced to, you know, when I go on book tour. So this conversation I was really hoping, I know, is going to be with other white settlers more than it is, you know, with anyone else. For me to say as loudly as I could, listen, it's not really what you think. You don't know what you don't know. There's this huge, tragic gap in our understanding and our knowledge and our wisdom, our humility and our ability to be ourselves personally liberated, that we're all missing, and we're deeply unhappy. We're addicted, exhausted, infighting, fragile. The white settler community is not robust.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we always want it to be other. Well, the drug addiction or the you know, the alcoholism or whatever of others, meantime, not looking. Yeah. But when we have an addiction problem, we say it's a medical emergency. But again, this, I think for me, just, yes, to bring to white settlers, I can't tell you all of the Lakota way of life.
Yeah.
At all. But I can tell you that it feels a lot wiser than where we are.
You know, I like how honest you're being about this, you know, this question of appropriation that's obviously coming up. That you talking about the fact that you're trying to get away from a dominant narrative. But one of the dominant narratives is that white people try to explain other cultures to white people. I mean, you're kind of owning this and dealing with it, I guess.
I mean, I think we have to. The white supremacy that we have in this country, the segregation that we have in this country, I mean, You have to be unconscious not to notice it right now. Willfully ignorant and deeply unconscious. So for me, it is disingenuous to pretend that this isn't going on. But I had to really wrestle with this. The world needs another white voice explaining to whites about, you know, others. That just seems to me a terrible arrogance. But in the end, writing the book dismantled my whiteness in such a liberating way. It changed the only person that it really has any hope of changing, right. And that's the writer.
Yeah.
If, from other perspective, it does something to other white settlers and gives them maybe a key to begin to dismantle their own internal racism, which is so hidden, and it's so wrapped up in ego and defensiveness that, no, I've dealt with it, or I've never been racist, or whatever it is. You know, for me, this was an opportunity to do that, and it felt in the end that my silence would be, you know, a more terrible thing than my speaking out, as long as, I mean, but writing this novel, I mean, truly dismantled me. I'm not the same person.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting this, you decide to write a novel now. I mean, you've tried it before, a number of times you've tried it before. And it seems like that when I'm looking at the style of it, I mean, I think on some level the writing style is similar, but in many ways it's also very different. And I'm wondering if this was part of what you were getting at by trying to get away from that dominant narrative. I mean, these chapters, maybe a page and a half, they're really short. And it's interesting, Emily Eakin in the New York Times says that you don't really narrate this book so much as poetically distill it. So is that what you were getting at? Was, as opposed to, you know, your prose that you're comfortable with, something more approaching maybe poetry?
That's lovely. It's a lovely way to put it. It was actually even more pragmatic than that, which was my effort to take up as little shelf room as possible. I didn't want to, you know, listen, Jonathan Franzen takes up three books, and that is part of, and sort of assuming that people have all the time and space in the world to listen to what you have to say. So I really wanted to be rather than do what I was saying. Does that make sense? I think that was maybe the greatest lesson of being with the Lakota was, how do you be? We already know what you do, and it is an interesting, you know, who are you is a very different question from what do you do.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, so there are two particular characters we'll talk about. We'll actually talk about three. Rick Overlooking Horse is one of the characters in the book. I want to ask you about what seems to be one of the inspirations for this character, Alex White Plume, because you've talked about this. Talk about Alex White Plume first, and that should get us to Rick.
Oh, he was this just incredible guide for me out of my own whiteness. I will be forever grateful to that man. He's a hemp grower. He's fought hard for the Lakota sovereignty in order to grow hemp. He had when I was visiting with him, Drug Enforcement Agency helicopter sort of strafing his property. He had a herd of Indian war ponies. His wife, Deborah White Plume, is an incredible Lakota activist, water activist, you know, heir. She's in her own right an amazing, amazing, you know, mother of the Lakota people. Yep. Alex completely balked when I said he was an elder. He said he was a middle-aged man and not yet actually at that, you know. But he, like a lot of Lakota, his initial contact with white settlers was harrowing. His father was shot by a cowboy outside of a bar in Gordon, Nebraska, leaving Alex to raise his siblings. He, like many, many indigenous members of the U.S., even though they did not get there, you know, did not become U.S. citizens until 1925, they fight for the U.S. military, the highest demographic percentage than anyone else. And Alex White Plume was in the army. And went through, you know, I think the awakening of every Lakota. He speaks Lakota. Anyway, one day he became an absolute touchstone for me to try and understand the way of life. And but he was so generous, so kind. One day he said to me, listen, before we carry on with this interview, I need to tell you something. He said, you know, when you ask me a question, I am happy to answer it because I feel like you really want to understand and that you will take this message to other white settlers about their continuing violence. But before I answer you, every time I speak to you, the first thing I have to do is forgive you and forgive everyone who looked like you. Forgive your ancestors. Forgive everyone who represents your privilege before I can even open my mouth and speak to you. Now, that was a very good place for me to begin every conversation on the res, was to remember that before someone responds, the first thing they have to do would be to forgive me.
I'm going to have you read a section. This is very early in the novel, kind of our introduction to Rick Overlooking Horse. And we should explain that another important character in the book is Rick's cousin. You choose Watson, and his grandmother, too, Mina Overlooking Horse, whom we'll meet in this section. Would you read this part about Rick and the fact that he didn't talk much?
Quiet until the thaw. They say Rick Overlooking Horse didn't talk much. Actually, it was a little more than that. From the start, even for an Indian, his silence was bordering on worrying. For example, in his fourth spring, when you choose Watson shot him in the leg with an arrow, he didn't go wailing to his grandmother like any normal kid. He turned his back on his res cousin's mocking laughter and limped away with the arrow still in his leg down the hill toward the third in a row of tar paper lean-tos on what is now Second Street in Manderson Village. Then he stood in the kitchen, silent as ever, staring at his closest immediate relation. Mina Overlooking Horse, accustomed to her grandson's silence, took a long time to look up from the back seat of the 1935 Ford coupe that had served as her sofa, since it had been torn from its crumpled mother chassis in a ditch outside Chadron, Nebraska. Then she noticed the dark, viscous pool spreading on the earth floor beneath Rick Overlooking Horse's feet and the arrow juddering from his leg. "Aye, you're making a mess of everything," she said. But Rick Overlooking Horse just blinked and stared at the dirt on which he was standing. Maybe he was wondering why you choose had just shot him in the leg with an arrow, or maybe he was wondering how he could mess everything up any worse than it already was. But no one would ever know what he was thinking about this or much of anything else, because the child wouldn't talk. It was like that swampy Cree Indian poem, Quiet Until the Thaw, as if his tongue must be frozen. Eventually his grandmother and some of his more concerned immediate relations thought to look in his mouth to make sure, but nope, everything was all defrosted and accounted for. Rick Overlooking Horse was simply a child, and then a man of shockingly few words.
Where did you choose Watson come from?
You know, I have one reader that he's a very close friend of mine, and I send everything I have to him. You know, I think that's important as a writer, to have a reader that you trust. And at that point, the story was really just a meditation on Rick Overlooking Horse, based on the character, both of White, of Alex Whiteplume, and also my father, weirdly, who had died while I was writing the novel. But I sent it to this friend and he said, but there's nothing going on. You need a protagonist. And one of the hardest things about losing my father was that it exposed deep rifts between my sister and I, my surviving sister and I. I had one sibling survived out of the five of us. And that really seemed to me to be at that moment where we were in this country, where as a community we were pulling apart, as families we were pulling apart, especially in the white settler community. And it really made me realize that on the res, there was so much talk of sort of families disintegrating, whether both, you know, through boarding school, through, the deep desire to numb this memory of genocidal pain and ongoing oppression through alcohol or drugs. I mean, the very understandable need to numb that pain, which, you know, we were doing as white settlers in my own family. And so having this counterpoint to Rick Overlooking Horse, I mean, I think it's so tempting as white settlers to want to believe that if you make it as a Lakota, now you're suddenly just going to be this wise, you know, medicine man who's going to cure us all. But the opposite can just as easily happen. Traumatized people behave in traumatized ways. Hurt people hurt.
It's so interesting the way Rick and you choose. The trajectory starts in the same place, and then it ends up in very different places. We don't—I don't propose to give anything away, but What is the I don't want to oversimplify this, but one of the essential elements that makes Rick go one way and you choose go the other, what do you think you were getting at there? What do you think that might be?
We've talked about it because I think it's God. I think that this was really my attempt to wrestle with what is it that if you're given the same set of circumstances, and actually you can have a purported belief in God and behave in the most violent, condemning ways. I mean, and be the most, I recoil from the term Christian. I would say that I'm a Christ follower rather than a Christian. I mean, Christ didn't say don't have enemies. He said love them. Oh, that's a very difficult and high bar for us to cross here. And so what does that look like in terms of, you know, this novel? I think if you take a divine that, you know, in the end, you choose Watson sort of rejects the message of the divine. He goes back after being in you know, being away from the res and tries to sort of go through the motions of finding God, much like, you know, many sort of white settlers go through the motions of finding Christ or God, but then reject the message because the message is too difficult. In a way, it's too simple. It's just it's love. And boy, we don't want that. We want, you know, it's much easier to fear, loathe, condemn.
Well, there's this moment that where young Rick and young you choose had spent this week at a Sundance ceremony. And there's this moment after they had witnessed part of this ceremony, and Rick sinks to his knees and he puts his hand and his forehead into the grass and he says, I'm yours. Use me. What's going on there?
I, years ago, became interested in, you know, the Catholic movement, the Catholic worker movements in South America, El Salvador, Uruguay. And there is an incredible movie of Oscar Romero, who was a bishop in El Salvador, was assassinated by the government, you know, backed by the U.S. at that point, back in the early 80s, for standing up for, you know, the working people of El Salvador, the poor. But at one point in this movie, which I highly recommend people watch, he realizes that he's up against forces bigger than himself, and one of his priests has been shot. You know, no one likes a messenger of peace. I mean, we crucified Christ for good reason. And he sort of rails against God for a minute. He says, I can't. And he says, you must. But eventually he sinks to his knees and he says, okay, I'm yours. Use me. And I stopped the movie at that moment and thought, wow, okay, that's what this is. You don't wield your divinity. You surrender to it. And I would say that that began my, you know, it's funny. All of this stuff goes into a novel, right, that you watched from a movie 10 years ago or that was your childhood. Or, I mean, that's the great thing about a novel. You can bring your whole lived life of experience and wisdom and learning into one place, such as it is. And, you know, I hope that it is double by the time, you know, I age. But, I mean, that really, I think, is what it was for me, was a recognition that at some point, in order to be truly a remarkable person, you surrender ego. And repeatedly, I think one has to re-surrender, maybe daily, to your purpose, you know, whatever you want to call it.
I want to have you read another section. I loved this part, and this is a moment describing Mina overlooking Horace. And this is on page 64. I want to have you read this section. Where does Mina come from first, before you read
you know,
this?
So she really represents for me that and I'm very specific about this, that she was born very shortly after her people even gained statehood, but she went through that horror of being removed off the res, taken to these remote boarding schools where they're, you know, Lakota were not allowed to speak their own language, weren't allowed to practice their spirituality. I mean, the only choice that Native Americans had left other than to commit suicide or to submit to genocide was to assimilate, which is in itself a kind of genocide. And so the fact that in spite of all that pressure, in spite of having so few choices, in spite of being this unwilling caretaker all her life, Mina Overlooking Horse, you know, somehow still makes it, somehow. I mean, they use that word on the res. I love that. It means almost miraculously, somehow. And there's a lot of it that's needed. I mean, let's never forget, the thing that really struck me when I went out onto the res is that the statistics are the same as they are in Haiti. So here we are in the middle of the United States. Life expectancy for men is, you know, between 46 and 48. Women, it's 52. Annual income, $4,000 a year. And that is, when you see that kind of terrible disparity, it's, you know, you realize that that's not an accident. That's been managed. And so for Mina Overlooking Horse to sort of go through this life, for example, when she had her own children, she gave them the least sort of the names that she thought would draw the least attention. She called them somebody, anybody, and nobody, in the hope that they would get overlooked, all this bad luck. And yet, you know, you can't overlook your fate. And so she really represents that vast, terrible, catastrophic waste of humanity that the white settler violence has imposed on, you know, this community. And so this is really the last moment when Mina Overlooking Horse crosses over. In spite of everything that had happened to her people and to her, Mina Overlooking Horse could never completely shake the feeling that she counted for something. No matter how many indignities and insults stacked up to prove her wrong, Mina could never quite get rid of the idea that her little haphazard piece of life was of consequence to someone, even if that someone was only herself. Or maybe even Wakantanka. Oh, Wakantanka. This had better be a plan to reduce us to metal. Mina Overlooking Horse sat down on the back seat of the 1935 Ford Coupe in a state of slightly stone distraction, which is what comes of taking a large dose of sacred weed with some strong coffee first thing in the morning before eating. Find the light, see the light, be the light through all this. Holy shit, Mina Overlooking Horse said suddenly, sitting bolt upright. Oh, holy, holy, holy shit.
You know, another one of the themes in the book that I wanted to ask you about was time. It's such a big one. And when Mina conveys to Rick the eternal nature of everything, as you put it in the chapter, and this idea of time, and it in a kind of literal way, it blows his mind. Right? Makes him sleepless but also exalted. I like that. And he broods about his existence. And then all the answers just open more trapdoors. And I wanted to ask you about this idea of time, because you write about time kind of a lot, actually. There's, you know, this in Leaving Before the Rains Come, you write about your father and this experience where he's smoking a pipe, and he talks about how smoking a pipe helps clear your mind because there's no definite end and no fresh start with a pipe properly smoked. I just wanted to get to that idea, that it's because that seems like one of the important ideas about this, that the Lakota idea of time or Native people's idea of time is different from the way we are thinking about it.
When I first came to this country, I heard somebody say that something had wasted their time. Don't be a waste of my time. And I laughed. I thought they were joking. But I didn't understand how somebody could make time theirs any more than you could make water yours or air yours. And that was really lucky. It was a holdover. I mean, in some ways, my childhood was so fortunate because I was raised in bubbles within bubbles within bubbles. So I deeply steeped in the indigenous community on one hand, with no oversight from distracted, you know, slightly boozy parents who were busy being white supremacists, who had a very transactional idea of time, that you paid for it, you bought it, it was yours. But it wasn't, that's not who they left me with. And then they sent me to boarding school and after for many years, 7 and a half till, you know, 18. And the thing about boarding schools, these, you know, strict Southern African boarding schools I was sent to, everything's about time, bells, your whole day. I mean, that's the whole point of institutionalization. And I hated it. I railed against it. And I understood it to be out of step with everything that fed my soul, seasons. And I mean, yes, just even fighting against light and dark, day and night, the way we do with, you know, we turn back our clocks. I mean, the whole wrestling match we do with time is so ridiculous. And we're terribly arrogant. You know, we say, oh, it's Africa time or it's there's that Indian time, as if it's a lesser idea of time instead of what it actually is, which is an understanding that time, like God, is infinite. This thing has been here forever. It'll be here at the end and anymore. My God, you can't control it. It's not going to be what you want it to be. And it's the whole mystery. I mean, I think properly understood, time and God are interchangeable. But, you know, one of the things that I did in order to try and sort of distill this thinking for myself, because it's as if I'm trying to describe a color that I don't yet have a word for. Because our language as white settlers is so limited. Now, from what I understand, in the Lakota language, this isn't, it's not difficult to describe because everything is understood, that you are in a cycle. And in a way that is a very, it both, I think, is very humbling and that you understand truly how insignificant you are. And also, I think it makes you feel a sense of responsibility that you show up for your time in the universe in this most peaceful, authentic, real way that you can.
So Rick, Overlooking Horse, finds a teepee that some, as you say, some California hippies had gotten rid of. And he sets it up when he returns from war on a piece of empty land. And I want to have you read a section here finally. He comes to this epiphany after that Sundance ceremony about time, time not being stable, time being like wind or current, not plodding forward, could flow backward. I want to say something about this chapter. I love the title of it, How to Make an Honest Living on the Res.
You know, that was, I was reading about the experience of the Irish when the American soldiers showed up in the Second World War in Ireland. And, you know, the Irish have an experience of being settled by Brits. They understand colonization. It's an interesting conversation to have, you know, with Northern Ireland. But I read a book about a journal kept by an Irish woman who said that the thing that most startled her about the U.S. was that they seemed just as wounded by their money as they were by their poverty. And that struck me as something, the insight that the Lakota kept trying to say. Well, if money is the key to happiness, you people certainly seem miserable and you keep coming here to steal our spirituality and learn our wisdom. So what is this thing? A man has to eat, but out of pity for a people who seem just as hurt by their prosperity as they were by their poverty, and out of concern for his own spiritual hygiene, Rick Overlooking Horse decided never to lay so much as the tip of a single finger on the deceased currency of the white man, not even in the form of his military pension or his disability allowance. Many of his immediate relations were incensed. Aye, one of them said, complete loss of the eye, code 6063. Do you know what that's worth? Another said, do you know what that's worth? Another said, it's the only way we're worth anything to them. Give him an eye, give him an arm, give him a leg. Heck, give him an eye, an arm, and a leg. A whole healthy working Indian ain't worth the skin he's in to the U.S. government. Rick Overlooking Horse rigged up a greenhouse of window panes salvaged from an abandoned white man's farm on the Res border and grew a crop of potatoes, beans, squash, and spinach. Then he dug up a section of the meadow that got the best of the morning sun, and he planted a crop of corn, a row of potatoes, and a patch of wahupta. In 4 months, he had his first half-pound harvest of the sacred weed. It was the perfect way for him to make a living. For a start, what's to say? He handed people twisted buds from the healing plant, and they handed him a bushel of corn or a sack of salt or a bag of coffee, or maybe they sang him a song or two. And no money need change hands. So in spite of what some of his immediate relations had predicted, Rick Overlooking Horse was never lonely on his land out there beyond Porcupine Butte. Not only were there enough men and women in need of herbal medicine to keep him abreast of the latest Rez gossip, but also the meadow around his teepee started to fill bit by bit with creatures that must have felt comforted by his presence. First ravens, rabbits, field mice, then a family of coyotes and an owl, and finally one morning, an old buffalo bull wandered into view as if he had finally found the place he wished to retire. The old bull had a brand on his rump, but Rick Overlooking Horse didn't put much credibility in human ownership of the sacred Tatanka, so he never bothered to find out from whose sacrilegious ranch the old bull had escaped. On cold nights, the bull lay up against the teepee, and Rick Overlooking Horse found he was comforted by the sound of the great creature chewing his cud, the rumble of his breathing. On hot days, the two of them lazed in the shade of the cottonwood trees where a little ground spring coursed west. Rick Overlooking Horse dangled his feet in the little stream and watched dragonflies. The old bull scratched himself against the tree's rough bark and cropped the sweet bluegrass that grew along the bank. Summer moved through the meadow as waves of color, the tender purples and yellows first. Loco weed, flax, bluebells, mustard, then a wave of pink and white. Geraniums, chickweed, yarrow, and roses. And then, just before the hottest week of the summer, a riot of blooms, balms, and cures of all colors. Beard tongue, prickly pear, field mint, catnip, mullein, aster. The whisper of dandelion gone to seed.
That image that you write about of being comforted by the sound of this buffalo chewing his cud, it's something familiar to you. It came from your own experience in your yurt.
Yeah, so my partner and I, he's an artist, Wendell Field. We lived together in a yurt. And one winter, actually, I wasn't there, but it was a very cold night, and two buffalo bulls came and lay against the canvas, and our bed pushes up against the canvas. And Wendell talked about being able to hear them chew their cud and breathe. And, you know, I've been close to sleeping bison who've come through our yurt park, but not right snug up against the canvas. And listening to Wendell, you know, recount that story, he sounded like he was in love, you know, when you're just giddy with that. He couldn't sleep all night. He said it was such an ecstatic experience.
It's Alexandra Fuller. Her book is called Quiet Before the Thaw. She joined us from community radio station KHOL in Jackson, Wyoming. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.